Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhasa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhasa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhasa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. So for the last couple of weeks, I've been in forest practice and really dedicating, making a strong determination to be out in the forest and taking advantage of that. And so one of the disadvantages of that is sometimes you kind of feel a little distant from the community. So it's kind of... I've known for a few days that I'd be giving the talk tonight, but not being in on the evening tea time or being around people at the tea times, morning pujas and things that you don't feel as connected, which isn't necessarily bad, but it oftentimes kind of informs what I'm contemplating, or when you ask to give a talk, it's oftentimes related to what's happening in the community. I have been using the time and contemplating, but it's it's like what I'm thinking about, what I'm contemplating, you're not always sure it's going to be of relevance to anybody else. So give my excuses to start off with here at the beginning. Before the tea time tonight, just sat down with a piece of paper and was just writing down, just jotting sort of some of the things that I had been contemplating, thinking about for the last 2 weeks. And it was funny, a lot of them, they all started with the letter S. So it was like silence, simplicity, sati, mindfulness. And in some way they all relate in how I was contemplating this last 2 weeks. So I'll just start talking about them and see what comes up. I don't really feel like I have, definitely nothing's prepared or anything, but I guess it was about 2 years ago, I myself and one of the other monks went over to our next door neighbor, Mount Tabor, and did a icon workshop. And was really inspired by that, and had the intention to go back. And Father Damien had offered to, and still has, to teach me how to do the icon painting from complete scratch. How to make the boards and make the pigments and everything. And I really wanted to take him up on that. So I've just now kind of arranged to go over for a private kind of workshop with him later in the year, but it took 2 years to get around to that. But also this spring, I think it was the week before the winter retreat ended, we had an Upasaka planning session, Ajahn Pasa and myself and three people from the Upasaka group were meeting, and I volunteered to do one of the presentations on devotion, which will probably be, I think it's in November or December, but it's going to be on artwork or creativity and as part of devotion practice. And so they immediately had the aspiration to start doing a little bit more study in that field. And almost immediately I did contact Father Damien and explained to him what I was wanting to do, and He assured me he had some books he wanted me to read, and so here it is, say 3 months, 2 months later, and finally last week I kind of was extremely persistent, and he brought over like 5 books for me to read. So I started this last week, been reading a lot about Christian iconography and painting, and just talking about, say, for me visually, and seeing things, the simplicity. One of the very first things I read in this book, when he was talking about an icon, Christian icon, is that was pointing out that in you know, that an icon is not supposed to be like an aesthetically pleasing painting. It's not a something you look at for enjoyment. It's usually not that kind of, like, it doesn't show a lot of emotion, and I haven't studied a whole lot of icons. Have an appreciation for them, but have never studied them or had anybody ever explain them to me in detail. But this, the author was just pointing out that in the icon, like, there's no expression of emotions in them, and so they're like the image, the overall feeling that you get from looking at that an icon is silence. That's the main, one of the main impetuses of the icon is to bring you to silence, to bring you into your inner world. And so I started looking at some of the paintings that I've been doing, and it was interesting. The first paintings that I was doing were much more in that sort of vein. I was pointing, like, in a Christian icon, you don't see images of, like, people, a lot of motion. There will be some, but it's not like expressive emotion, movement, or like even say like the icons of the Christ being crucified. There's not the emotion of anguish on his face or anything like that. It's more of a, it would be much more serene, and then you would bring into it that quality of emotion and your understanding of the story, and you'd be contemplating it in that sense. But the visual is not to stir that up. And so I was looking at a painting that I was actually working on, and it's one that I've never quite really felt 100% comfortable with. But it was a 2 years ago when I was at Mount Tabor. One of the paintings that Father Damien was working on was called Seraphims. They're these light beings, and they're sort of praising God, praising Jesus. So I was thinking, well, how could you do that in kind of a Buddhist way? And I found some images that I kind of like, and did a few paintings with these kind of, I call them devas, sort of rejoicing around the Buddha. And at some level they work, because it's like there's this kind of commotion and motion around the Buddha, but the Buddha's painted like a Buddha image, a statue, where it's just very quiet and serene and very, very peaceful. And the ones that have worked out that I've painted, it's like the Buddha image just becomes the focus, because it is it's the still point, it's the quietness, and you kind of see the devas around the outside, and it is kind of a little bit disturbing or exciting, and so the mind, the eye tends to want to go towards the Buddha image. But just looking at it again with that kind of that understanding of how the icon works, it's like, well, yeah, why are you even adding the tension in the first place? Is it actually necessary? And so I we're reflecting on this, not just in the artwork, but just in life in general. Do we, how to, simplification, simplifying our lives, bringing in silence into our everyday experiences. And say earlier this week, I read a, for the morning reflection, I was listening to a talk of Jack Kornfield. It was more of an interview that he was giving in kind of a lecture, as a lecture series, and he was being interviewed, and then about half of it was also question and answers from the audience. So it wasn't an extremely like thought out talk, but it was on, the main theme was on mindfulness, on sati. And I'm kind of bringing this up because it's like, like reading up about the icons, like taking inspiration from, say, a Christian tradition, and bringing that back into the way we practice here. And then it was interesting, like, most of the readings that I would do or listening to Dhamma talks, it's almost entirely from monastics in our tradition. There's just such a wealth of information there, and if you just listening to the Dhamma from living here, then it's we have a particular culture, particular way of talking, a language that we have of our own, which works for us. And so it was interesting listening to Jack, because he's also Theravada Buddhism and teaches Samatha and Vipassana meditation, but they have a different culture, a different way of presenting Dhamma. One of the things they do is like what I was reading was they throw in a lot of quotes, and a lot of the quotes are from different traditions, different countries, different fields. It wouldn't even be religious people. They throw in business people or philosophers, and that sometimes helps people connect, and so it can be a skillful way of approaching. But I also found it interesting that I think I was talking about this at least at tea time one night, that when I first became interested in Buddhism, I remember the kind of debates at the time were all about Vipassana and Samatha. Like, should you be doing one or the other, or which one's better? And there were also debates about how much concentration you needed to get into jhana, and lots of kind of verbal written sort of arguments and all the magazines and things like this about those kinds of things. And even being a new student, young student, I was reading all this and trying to figure it out on my own, or trying to sort through it. And then after coming here, I just found just the practice of just being here, just learning how to live harmoniously, just how to get through the day, that was enough. I didn't pretty much kind of put down all that kind of reading. So in many ways, I really don't know what's happening in terms of what's being published in the lay journals and things like that. So it was interesting listening to Jack talk, because maybe I'm be misrepresenting him, but say the talk was about mindfulness, and it really sounded like he was at least the quality. He was really stressing the quality of mindfulness, of being very similar to loving kindness, of talking about it in terms of just having that open receptiveness to what we're doing in the world, how we're relating to ourselves, our own emotions, our own feelings, but also to other people. And so I was appreciating that way of looking at it. But I think he made some sort of comment that over the period of time that he's been teaching, that loving kindness has been almost been given too much emphasis. It was kind of interesting. I'll have to go back and if I can find the talk again, re-listen to it. And it's not that as Westerners we have been doing it too much or don't need it, but he was saying that it's almost like at this point in practice, or what he's seen is, it's like compassion is more of a quality that needs to be kind of focused on more. And I know Ajahn Pasno was reading a book I've been waiting to get my hands on from the monk who had been the translator for His Holiness the Dalai Lama for many years. And so it could be something that this is a tough topic that has been discussed quite a bit. But since I'm not reading those journals and things, it does seem to it's come up several times recently. And during this interview, also one of the things that struck me was because the talk was given to people. It was actually in San Francisco, so I think there was quite a few Buddhists in the audience, and probably people had a retreat experience. And so a very common question is like, if you come to a monastery or go to a retreat, and you spend a week, 10 days here on retreat for a period of time, you can get, your life is quieter, and it is simpler, and So, you know, how do you take that, you know, back out into the world? That's a very, very common question. And I was really impressed with Jack's answer, because he really got to, right intention. Because and this is kind of how that ties into, it's like, because, you know, right intention is basically loving kindness and compassion, not non-harming and compassion. But it's also renunciation. And it's like, that's one of the, you know, qualities of intention that you don't hear quite so much talked about, and maybe in retreat situations. And so he was, you know, pointing out that, you know, we do have, especially to this audience, that, you know, probably most people were extremely hardworking, had very busy lives, probably most of them living in San Francisco or the area. And so, you know, things are expensive. People probably had, good paying jobs that had a lot of demands and a lot of responsibilities and duties. And so, you know, acknowledge that, like, okay, you know, these are choices that we've made. You know, it's not necessarily that you have to have that, but we do have choices. And, he did acknowledge too, it's like, you know, yeah, there are practices you can do. You can, you know, set a mindfulness bell that goes off at your desk every hour just to remind you to come back to the breath, or you can have a dedicated practice of, you know, getting up early enough in the morning to have a sit before you go to work, and you can, you know, make a strong determination to have a practice in the evening, and you know, do all these things that are good and skillful and wholesome. But he really brought it right back to the looking at our choices in terms of renunciation. That if we really do want to have, you know, that peace, we want to have some silence in our lives, that's a choice that we have to make, and that we have to figure that out for ourselves. And just at tea time, I was still reading one of these books on the icon, and the this writer made that exact point, just that making choices in our lives, and like kind of made the point of, like, you know, if you're moving, and you had a going through your house, and so you're downsizing, you know, going to a more simple lifestyle, you know, that you have to, you know, go through all of your possessions and, you know, figure out which ones are valuable, which ones are worthy of keeping, and then, you know, and learning to let go of the other, the items that we've accumulated that aren't helpful. And so I think one of the, you know, contemplating the, you know, the icons, and, you know, that comment again, that, you know, that the image of the icon is about the silence, and that, you know, coming back to the silence, coming back to simplicity, actually, you know, seeing that, actually having a visual image or some sort of understanding of that is something that we take for value, that we have value in. I think all of us value simplicity, all of us value silence. But if it's not something that we consciously bring into our awareness, you know, these aren't things that are just going to happen on their own. Yeah, the other thing that I've been, you know, contemplating this week, kind of in relation to that, is it's talking to Lumpur about aging, and seeing some people around me who are starting to, I think, make poor decisions based on, say, lack of, you know, discernment. Seeing that it's not that they're not wise, but just as the aging process happens, it's very easy to get scammed by scam artists trying to rip off elderly people, or And you know, the person who is being scammed, you know, it's like they're probably doing it, you know, getting scammed with, you know, they're obviously not doing it, you know, with the, you know, they don't have bad intentions. They're probably trying to do something based out of wisdom. You know, like they're making decisions thinking that this is something that will be good and right and maybe it's necessary. And so I was, you know, talking to Lumpur about this, and you know, what came up for me about this was, it's like, you know, the decisions we're making right now are going to affect if we're fortunate enough to live to be old and possibly have our faculties go, if we're able to live that long. You know, how we act and how we respond in situations like that is not so much like the knowledge or the, you know, what we've read, how smart we are. That's not going to kind of affect those situations, but it's the quality of the heart that we're developing right now. So like, maybe not even a situation like with a scam artist, but like, you know, as we get older and see discernment, or that faculty of mind that can rationalize and think and make, you know, discernment kind of decisions, if that doesn't always for everybody, but for a lot of people it does. It's a, you know, if those sorts of things happen in the brain is an organ and it deteriorates and might get diseases or become faulty. But the, you know, those qualities of the heart, you know, I think, you know, do remain. So it's like, like when we're in a situation here now, it's like, you know, really paying attention to, like, if we're in a situation where we don't feel comfortable about something, or you know, we're asked to do something, or someone comes at us with an emotion that we don't feel comfortable with, you know, like, how do we respond to that? And you know, if we for a lot of my life, you know, it's like when I'm met with anger, met with aversion, met with force, you know, my upbringing in sports and things like that was to kind of match force with force. And the longer I in the monastic robes, the less and less that feels appropriate, or more and more kind of uncomfortable it feels to, you know, to react in that way. And so the turning the heart towards, you know, how do you respond to the situation like that with kindness or with you know, concern. Also, too, in the last 2 or 3 weeks, visiting Dr. Bracewell, he sees quite a few of the community members here, and a lot of his training, a lot of what he does is teaching us, you know, about posture and really paying attention to our physical bodies. And I think it was the last time, so it was probably 3 or 4 weeks ago that I saw him, he had me starting a brand new stretch, and he was pointing out that in my lower back and in my buttocks, I was holding a lot of tension back there, and that probably was causing, you know, 99% of the other physical ailments that are pains that I have in, you know, with my knee and legs. And one thing he pointed out, just talking about, you know, like sort of body awareness, I think probably other people have heard this before, but he said he really loves working with people who are meditators, and particularly people from, you know, this community, because he said, like, when he does a session with people, if he can get them to relax, like, one time during their session, he feels like he's kind of accomplished something. But, like, you know, he might with most of us do, like, you know, 5 or 6 different kind of stretches, and usually for each stretch he'll do with us, every one of us will have, like, say, you know, 4 or 5, 6 sort of, you know, like major kind of release, at least 2 or 3, you know, kind of releases into that stretch. And it's just because, you know, being here, we've trained to be able to look at the body and to know our bodies. Not that we're all, you know, complete experts on it. He definitely knows the body, I think, way better than most of us do. But when he was showing me this newest stretch that I've been doing, I just started becoming aware throughout the entire day. It almost became my entire meditation, whenever I've been walking around and moving, it just paying attention to my lower back, and just actually being quite shocked by how often I was tensing it in situations where it was not, I would say, inappropriate, but it was completely unneeded. And it just became kind of like a habit, or, you know, I can imagine that the first couple of times that the body started doing that, it was to protect an injury, or protecting the body when it felt vulnerable. But in the process of that, when that lower back is really tight, then all the other muscles are trying to sort of, you know, react or move in full motion, but they can't because the lower back is, like, you know, blocking sometimes up to, you know, 50% or more of your motion. But if the other muscles are still trying to move at full motion, it's like you can see the stress and tension and so, like, a knee injury probably had nothing to do with the knee at all. It was the lower back that actually caused the knee injury. And so this last 2 weeks, just really paying attention to the lower back, and just, you know, learning to that quality of attention of seeing where tension's being held. And the thing is, like, as soon as I get that sense of, I think the very first time I noticed it was just sort of just getting ready to walk up the hill and just looking at the steps out here, heading up towards the Buddha Rupa, and then, you know, bringing my attention to the body posture and walking the way Bill's, you know, told us to walk. And I just realized, oh, my back is just, like, really, really tight. And just as soon as I realized that, just bring attention to it, and probably just because of the training we've done, but I was able to just completely relax it. And that's because of the physical therapy that Bill's done. I just knew exactly where those muscles were. I knew where the release point was because he's been sticking his elbow in it and putting a lot of pressure on. So I just put the focus there and just completely relaxed. And then walking up and just keeping it relaxed, and then at a certain point noticing it was tensing, and then just bring it there. And so, you know, practicing that way for a couple of weeks, and I started noticing, you know, and more in, say, intellectual or emotional situations, like Ajahn Kriyadhamma, I think, mentioned this during the Owada at the end of the Patimokkha, just sort of noticing, when someone says something to you, and how we create identity around that, or if we have a strong sense of identity, I'm the senior monk, and I ask someone to do something, and they don't do it, then, you know, it's like, oh, they're challenging me, and then feeling uncomfortable about that, and then, you know, getting upset. And it's like, you know, I've been focusing on that a lot, especially since this, seeing this with the lower back and seeing it with the mind. Yeah, I'm kind of realizing that, you know, basically any time that I have that feeling of mental pain, for whatever reason, it's because I'm holding something wrong. You know, it's not what the other person did or what the other person said. You know, they may not have been beautiful, or they may have actually even been wrong. But there's no reason that I have to suffer because of that. And again, in this book on the icons, I read this beautiful line. Forget exactly how he brought it up, but he's interviewing this monk and talking about monastic life. And he said, you know, one of the qualities that they try to strive for with each other is not having, you know, animosity towards each other. And he says, we treat each other as one corpse would have, you know, kindness towards another corpse. And I love that image. It's like, you know, you have two dead corpses there on the ground, and they're not going to be fighting with each other. And it's kind of interesting image on many different levels. Like, you know, we are going to be corpses, and so it's like, when you actually have that, that's more like the kind of the body awareness that Ajahn Dunn was talking about. You know, just really contemplating death, contemplating the impermanence of this physical body. And then you start seeing the issues that we take as serious and real, and that we want to fight for, that they're really usually quite pointless, and they're not helpful in the long run. And so I just read that quote yesterday, so I haven't had a chance to work with it too much yet, but I think it's an interesting image, you know, this my corpse dealing with your corpse. You know, it's like, you know, why does there need to be an issue? Why does there need to be any tension there? And then, you know, if we learn skillful ways to do this, if we can learn in our own ways, just sort of, how can we, you know, train ourselves to do this? You know, I think there's you know, obviously immediate results in the present moment of being able to return to stillness, to quiet. But I think in the long run, it'll you know, if we're blessed to have old age, that you know, in those situations in the future, then it would just become our habit. It will become our natural way of dealing with life and with situations, and that you know, too, I just, you know, thinking of, you know, a patient who is somebody that's you know, cantankerous and difficult to be around and things like that. You know, it's like everybody here would take care of each other and support them, but it's, you know, it's more difficult to, you know, kind of want to be around somebody who's difficult. And I remember two years ago, it was like when we were over doing the Icon workshop, there was an older man there named Jack who was going through the last stages of cancer, and he was just radiant as he was going through that last stage, and, you know, I think everybody just loved being around him. So I think, you know, in the long term, you know, sort of working on these issues, working on, you know, just learning to, yeah, to not pick up those negative emotions, will have benefits in the present and into the future. And we'll leave that for our reflection this evening.
Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.